So we will be in Proverbs 21, finishing up Proverbs 21 tonight, and hopefully doing the first part of 22 before we start what I think is an intriguing section, the 30 sayings of the wise. We'll get there. But we're going to be picking up 21, verse 25 tonight, because I think is how far we made it. We stopped with the scoffer, is the name of the arrogant, haughty man who acts with arrogant pride. I think it was the last one we talked about last week. So. Okay, let's read tonight and finish out the chapter here. Tim, would you mind reading for us Proverbs 21, verses 25 through 31?
25 through 31. The desire of the sluggard kills him, for his hands refuse to labor. All day long he craves and craves, but the righteous gives and does not hold back. The sacrifice of the wicked is an abomination, how much more when he brings it with evil intent. A false witness will perish, but the word of a man who hears will endure. A wicked man puts on a bold face, but the upright gives thought to his ways. No wisdom, no understanding, no counsel can avail against the Lord. The horse is made ready for the day of battle, but the victory belongs to the Lord.
All right. Lots of good stuff here. What stands out to you guys, 25 through 31? In this last section of chapter 21.
Are 25 and 26 run together? Because just as I was reading that, and then all day long he craves seems to be referring back.
Yes. It's rare that you get a four-line proverb, but I think that this is an example of a four-line proverb. Verses 25 and 26 go together. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And is very helpful and is talking about the sluggard. We're going to read some more about him. We've already seen the sluggard, which is always just a funny word to me. It's like one of those Bible words. Like, yeah. I don't know if we ever use it. What would we call the sluggard?
Lazy.
Yeah, lazy guy, right?
Lazy bones.
Lazy bones. Yeah.
Couch potato.
Yes, there you go. Which is kind of funny that a sluggard has kind of an animal name in it. You get slug. And then someone who's slothful also has an animal name in it. I got to see a sloth the other week at the zoo thing, like a little mini zoo. It was really cool watching a sloth. But you see why they're like, yeah.
Did you look at him and say, oh, thou sluggard?
I didn't call him slothfully.
Oh, man.
Tell him to go to the ant.
That's right. Go to the ant. Oh, sluggard, slothful.
Sluggard.
Anyway.
Slothard.
Slothful.
There we go. Okay, but we digress. So it's just really cool. I think the way verse 25, at least in the English Standard Version, the desire of the sluggard kills him, for his hands refuse to labor. Isn't that weird? Like a desire can kill you. And I think the idea is like he craves and he wants this thing, and that's why verse 26 expands on it. All day long he craves and craves. But his desire ends up killing him because it doesn't work. He won't go and get what he needs. He won't work with his hands what's good. And I think it's also interesting that it's contrasted with the righteous in verse 26, but the righteous gives and does not hold back. Ugh. What's really interesting about this is you think of the opposite would be like, but the righteous works, but it's not just works. It's the righteous gives. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's really cool to see that biblically, it's not just the goal to go from not working to working. Mm-hmm. The goal is to go from not working to working to giving.
I also think there's a kind of hidden emphasis on the not desiring, because if you're giving stuff away freely, then obviously it's not something that you're holding in your heart and you're desiring constantly, whereas the sluggard, he's that's all he's consumed by, so that's all he's going to think about. If they're righteous, they're just saying, oh no, go ahead, take it. It's obvious where their heart is, and it's not in those things.
Yes, there's a good point, Tim.
I'm thinking about like, what is it that the sluggard values so highly? What is it that he desires? And I think in the end, at least one way of looking at this is that he desires ease or something, comfort, or desires not, you know, something that goes along with having to work. Because, I mean, there's times where you may not like your job, but the consequence of not doing your job, even though you don't like it, is worse. And yet the sluggard, who, you know, as it is described here, his hands refuse to labor, there's something that he likes worse than working. Or no, that's not what I'm trying to say. So he doesn't I can't even think out of sentence, but like
accomplishment.
Like he's not motivated. Right? Mm. Like there's times where like, oh, I really want to stay in bed, but if I don't get up now, you know, I'm gonna get to work late and it's gonna go badly, and I'm gonna, you know, and that's gonna have an effect on the whole week. And, you know, like there's some sense of if I don't get up, then if I don't work, then things are gonna go poorly. And for the sluggard, sometimes there's not that connection.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so there's something that, like, whether it's ease or just laziness or something that they value higher than whatever it is that we could accomplish by working. It was right. Value it.
Unfortunately, I have some personal experiences with sluggards. So I'm not surprised that it's like right next to the verse about arrogant pride. So I think what is really ironic here is that they're so fooled by themselves that they're actually arrogant. And then they don't want to, like, that's why they think they're like self-righteous about it.
Right.
Like they don't want to work, and it's self, like, but you don't have, like, you know, like, you don't know how you're going to eat. It's kind of weird.
That's right.
Yeah. So it's like, it's just a mindset that's unfortunately really ego-based. And it's just kind of ironic because you don't think that when you look at them, because you look at them, you think that must be so humbling to live like that. But it's not really,
yeah.
You know, so I think it's next to the arrogant pride thing with who acts with arrogant pride on, like, I think there's something in that. Then they go on to the desire of the sluggard. So.
Yeah. And I don't want to get political here, but I mean, you don't have to look very far, just anywhere in our world, our country right now, to see that this is an issue that we're struggling with. Motivation to work is like a big deal. And these ideas have consequences. And when you sometimes when you incentivize laziness and not working, that's, I mean, we're already sometimes want something more than the fear something more. Again, it's hard to put it into words. It's hard to nail it down. But we know what you're talking about, Sam. But it's interesting to me. This is 3,000 years old. This is not talking about America. But it's so applicable that, like, we need motivation to work. And we're going to see some more Proverbs later on where, like, a worker's appetite works for him and motivates. But that when you take away the motivation to work, our self-control is very weak many times. And so this is helpful principles here. Other things that stand out to you guys, things that are helpful to y'all in these verses 25 through 31.
The last one. I forget what your translation said, but this one is, the horse is prepared for the day of battle, but the victory belongs to the Lord.
Yes, mine's almost identical. I love that one as well. Like, you can be as ready as you want. Get your horses ready. I guess in modern day, like, get your tanks ready, get your missiles ready. You know, the aircraft is made ready for the day of battle, but the victory belongs to the Lord. It doesn't matter if you have the most advanced weaponry, which in those days, the chariot was like the big deal, you know, getting your horses ready for battle, but the victory belongs to God.
It's interesting because I was thinking of this from, like, the other bookend. So you're saying, like, you may do all this, but the glory still goes to God. And the other side of that is the glory is going to go to God, but you still have your part to do.
Mm. Oh, interesting. Right? Yeah.
Like prepare the horse, you know, get yourself ready. like there's that, you know, requirement, you know, that, that participation, not that you're going to be responsible for the victory. That's still, you know, to God's credit, but you still have your part to play.
Yeah. And it reminds me of like Proverbs 16:9, the heart of man plans his way, but the Lord establishes his steps. Or even like 16:1, the plans of the heart belong to man, but the answer of the tongue is from the Lord. Those verses are not saying don't make plans, but they're saying like, realize that you're planning, you're trying to move forward, but ultimately things are going to go the way God wants them to go, whether that's a battle or just whatever it is that you're planning. We should say, if the Lord wills, we will go and do this or do that. I was in another study today. We were in James 4 talking about that passage. And also, there's a really cool psalm that goes with that. I think it's Psalm 20, which is like a blessing psalm. But it talks about horses and chariots here. Yeah, here it is. In Psalm 20, verse 7, some trust in chariots and some in horses, but we trust in the name of the Lord our God. They collapse and fall, but we rise and stand upright. So I really like that connection here with Proverbs 21. The horse is made ready for the day of battle, but the victory belongs to the Lord. Other things that stand out to you guys in these? Joe?
Verse 27, it's the sacrifice of the wicked is an abomination. How much more when he brings it with evil intent? Mm-hmm. There's definitely a he makes it. The word I'm looking for. He distinguishes between the two, where it's like there's an evil person, they make a sacrifice, that's an abomination. But it's even more so if he's doing it on purpose with, you know, evil in his heart. And so there is a distinct there is, wow, I can't think, my brain's just it's gone. It's gone out.
It's been gone a while.
Yeah, yes. But he definitely distinguishes between there's evil done without realizing it, and there's evil done, and you know it's evil.
Right. Yeah. So. I was thinking a little bit about Ananias and Sapphira in Acts chapter 5 with this, that what they're bringing is a sacrifice to God. It's financial. You know, they sold property. But they're coming, not only do they have wicked hearts and bringing it, but they're bringing it with evil intent. In a sense, like they're doing it for their own glory. And they're lying about, oh, you know, we gave all of the money that we got. And of course, we see what the Lord thinks about that in Acts 5. Mm-hmm. But that's just an interesting, that was something that came to my mind reading mm-hmm. that one.
And maybe the first part of that verse, I don't know, kind of, it's like apples and oranges, but Uriah. No, not Uriah. Thank you, Uzza.
Yeah,
appreciate it. Two unions, but you know, him putting out his hand, you know, wanting to do good, but it was a sin, you know, to study the or touch the Ark of the Covenant.
I think that verse 30 is really interesting because it doesn't sound like most of the other Proverbs. It's just like this statement. There's not exactly parallelism in it. But it just said, no wisdom, no understanding, no counsel can avail against Yahweh. I just think it's really cool to think about that.
Amy? It was kind of making me think about Job a little bit, where it's like these people thought that they were so powerful with their wisdom and their counsel and their great understanding of God's ways, but like ultimately they couldn't make those calls for the Lord. They couldn't know his heart or reason past him.
Yeah. And it makes me think a lot about just our culture right now is so impressed with academia and great, what we consider to be great wisdom, great learning, like all of our science, all of our psychology, all of this stuff, which again, there's nothing wrong with those fields in and of themselves. But sometimes people end up, and I can end up like this, they end up thinking they're smarter than God. And like, oh, like, I know the Bible says that, but have you seen this article? Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, wow, like, this is just amazing. New, figured this out. And there's no understanding or wisdom or counsel that can avail against the Lord. It also reminds me of Psalm 2 when it says the kings of the earth take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed. And he who sits in the heavens laughs, you know, like, there's no counsel, no amount of people that you get together that's going to actually be able to thwart what the Lord purposes and what he's ordained. Tim?
It was, I don't imagine Solomon sitting down and just cranking out all of these Proverbs at yeah. one go, or even in large chunks.
That was a good afternoon. I had a whole chapter.
I'm going to throw down a bunch of lines about sluggards. Here we go. You know, like, but like, I imagine these kind of coming to him, like, you know, like he's going about his business and something occurs to him and he's like, wow, lesson learned. I'm going to write this down. It just kind of has this like collection of.
He has like his Moleskine notebook in his pocket. Right now. Yeah. He's like jotting down.
Oh, and he was a king. He had to have
his scribe.
His personal scribe there, you know, and just like
Baruch. Come.
but like this one. Did something lead to this, to him saying, sitting down one day, you know, just going, oh, you know what? No wisdom, no counsel, no whatever, you know, can avail against the Lord. Like that was what his takeaway from some experience was. And I think there's times that we have those kinds of takeaways from like, if you make a mistake or even if you almost make a mistake sometimes, like almost lock yourself out of the house. You're like, oh, I caught the door just in time. Wow, let that be a reminder to me. So like, I don't know, maybe he did something or maybe almost did something that made him realize, ooh, yeah, no amount of human wisdom is going to prevail against God.
Yeah. And I also think it's fascinating that verses 30 and 31 are next to each other. Going back like Elizabeth, you pointing out the other ones. But here in verse 30, it's like more the intellectual things, like no intellectual power can avail against the Lord. And in verse 31, it's kind of the military power, no physical strength or military power. The victory belongs to the Lord, regardless of how ready you are. So I think that's fascinating because we might be tempted, different ones of us, to trust in one thing or another. Like we might not be like, oh, I'm going to overpower someone, but we might be like, oh, like, that wisdom, that understanding, or whatever. So I just think that's interesting, seeing those two together. Other comments, thoughts on this section here?
That was a solid section.
It's good.
I think we addressed every verse there. Mm-hmm.
Just about. We missed a couple. But yeah.
Verse 29 stood out to me some. The first thing I thought of when it said a wicked man puts on a bold face is like trying, I don't know if this is actually what it meant, but just kind of the first thing that occurred to me that it would mean is like he's putting on a bold face and like he's trying to overcome something, or I guess like confidently do something, but he isn't really trying, or he isn't really going to get it done, or something like that. I don't know, but
or he's trying to look confident.
Right.
And the contrast is the upright gives thought to or establishes his way. So the upright man is concerned about doing what's right and going about it the right way. And then however that appears to other people is not as important, whereas the wicked man is going to be doing things in underhanded ways and deceitful ways, but he's going to try to put up this facade of everything's fine mm-hmm. when it isn't fine.
Yeah, but that one caught my eye too, Layla, because like Tim's talking about, you've got sometimes the person who talks the loudest and the most confidently, everybody listens to them. And that doesn't necessarily mean they're wise. And so here, again, I think about sometimes, what made Solomon write that one down? You know, like, was there some loudmouth guy who swayed all of his counselors? Like, oh, guys, no, this is it. I'm sure, you know, and they're just like laying it out. And they might have a bold face, but they haven't given thought to their ways. They're excited about it, maybe loud about it. But just the person who speaks the loudest or the fastest or the most eloquently puts on a bold face is not necessarily wise. It's the one who actually gives thought to their ways.
I've had little Solomon-like imaginary visions as well, where like if there's a lot of things that are clustered next to each other, or not next to each other, but in the same proverb, I imagine like the scrap went, Solomon, you have to spread them apart.
Yes, yes. We need to, you've been doing a lot of sluggards lately. Try something else.
Come on, Solomon. Yes. Oh, that's great. We need to develop. Maybe his name is Baruch, and he's like this little guy following Solomon around. He's like, Baruch, I have a new proverb. Yes, Solomon, what is it?
Do you see this insect, Baruch? It is an ant. Look to it. Look to the ant.
Oh, I love this. This is good. This is good. Okay, man, we could. There's some good YouTube material here. we could go a ways with this. Okay, chapter 22. We're going to read this in two parts, and we're going to stop at verse 16, and then pick up next week. Where are we around to? Layla, would you mind reading for us 22, 1 through 8?
Sure. Good name is to be chosen rather than great riches, and favor is better than silver or gold. The rich and the poor meet together, and the Lord is the maker of them all. The prudent sees danger and hides himself, but the simple go on and suffer for it. The reward for humility and fear of the Lord is riches and honor in life. Thorns and snares. Wait, how far did you want me to
read? Through verse 8.
Okay. Thorns and snares are in the way of the crooked. Whoever guards his soul will keep far from him. Train up a child in the way he should go. Even when he is old, he will not depart from it. The rich rules over the poor, and the borrower is the slave of the lender. Whoever sows injustice will reap calamity, and the rod of his fury will fail.
Okay. What stands out to y'all in this section, 22, 1 through 8?
Verse 8, the rod of his fury will fail. I just think of, like, the rod, like, God talks about a lot about a shepherd and his rod and how it guides and comforts. And this very opposite rod that is full of fury and using to inflict pain or strife. And it's talking about like sowing injustice, and God is full of justice, and just a very opposite picture.
Yeah, that's a great point. And the upside down Psalm 23. Yeah. And then just the law of the farm, sowing injustice and reaping calamity. Mm-hmm. You reap what you sow. Other ones that stand out to y'all here.
Verse three and five are very similar, I feel like.
Yeah, that's a good point. The prudent sees danger and hides himself, but the simple go on and suffer for it. Thorns and snares are in the way of the crooked. Whoever guards his soul will keep far from them. Yeah, that's a good point. They're kind of an opposite order. Mm-hmm. But basically, the wise person's alert. And they're like, oh, I see that coming. And they stay away, whereas the simple just aren't paying attention, or the ways of the crooked are full of thorns and snares, yeah, lots of pitfalls for them. Joe?
It reminds me of that one poem I think you put up in one of your lessons on purity.
Oh, there's a hole in my sidewalk?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Where it's like, I see the hole, I step in it. I see the hole, I walk close, but then I fall in it. I see the hole, I walk by it slowly or whatever, and then it ends with, I took a different street, you know?
Yes.
And so it's, a lot of it is that you see it, you walk into it, but if you just don't even go there, it won't be a problem.
Yeah, let me pull that up real quick. This is a poem by, go ahead, Tim.
No, I was just going to say, part of it is if you know better.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. That you should do better.
Yeah.
Yes. So this is a poem by Portia Nelson, P-O-R-T-I-A. It's very short, but this is just, there's a lot of biblical wisdom distilled in this. It's chapter one. I walk down the street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I fall in. I am lost. I am helpless. It isn't my fault. It takes forever to find a way out. Chapter two. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I pretend I don't see it. I fall in again. I can't believe I'm in the same place, but it isn't my fault. It still takes me a long time to get out. Chapter three. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I see it is there. I still fall in. It's a habit. My eyes are open. I know where I am. It is my fault. I get out immediately. Chapter four. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I walk around it. And chapter five. I walk down another street. So that's just the prudent sees danger and hides himself, but the simple go on and suffer for it.
You can almost like, if you're sharing with somebody else who's, you know, struggling with some temptation, you just be like, hey, what chapter are you on?
Yeah.
Where are you in this process?
Yeah. Hey, what sidewalk you walking down?
That's right. Yes. But that's really helpful. There's just so much truth in that, of the process of getting addicted to something and then trying to get out and eventually learning, I just need to not go near the temptation. I need to walk down another street entirely instead of pretending like, how close can I get without, you know, falling in?
I saw a video. It's kind of a similar thing, but I saw this one time. It's like a duck and he's walking. It's like an animated thing. There's a duck and he's walking along and there's this like yellow blob and he sniffs it and he drinks it and he like, I think it's about like getting drunk, but he like floats up in the air and he just feels amazing. And then after a second, he plops down to the ground and then he walks past it and then he keeps walking and he encounters it several more times. But each time, I think the time he's up in the air gets shorter, and when he falls, it's harder and he gets more hurt. And then at the end, he comes, and like by the end, he's all like scruffy and beat up. And by the end, the last time he comes to the yellow blob, he just stares at it and doesn't do anything. And then that's where it ends. Yeah. So I don't think he really changed much. He made up a look. I think it was called the bad duck or something. Yeah, he stayed on the sidewalk.
Sounds like he got as far as chapter four.
Yeah, that's right. I'm getting out of
here. It's 2D.
I stared at the blob.
It's not my fault.
For me, like, in a more, like, day-to-day example of, like, verse five, where, like, you kind of just walk into things in your path, like, I find when I'm, like, losing my patience, especially, like, with the kids I work with, I always, like, trip on stuff more when I'm losing my patience because I don't care. Like, I'll trip on, like, a chair leg or a toy left out or just kind of, like, bowl stuff over because I'm frustrated and I don't care to be careful anymore. And I don't know, in life, it's, like, the more you just want to, like, get through something or you're frustrated or you're discouraged, you just kind of, like, walk through whatever. It doesn't matter if it's in your way, it doesn't matter if it's a bad thing, it's just like, who cares anymore? That's just kind of what made me think of,
or when yes. you're frustrated, more things happen that make you more frustrated.
Yeah, like you knock something over,
you're less careful. Yes. Like you're walking by a doorknob and it catches yes. your earbuds and it rips them out of your ears. And then you're just like, and it's all downhill.
Yes,
exactly.
Yes,
the worst feeling ever.
Yeah.
Just like, I was like, how does a door handle catch your ear?
That's what you think at the moment too. And then it happens.
It feels so, like my ear just got ripped out.
I digress. Sorry.
No. We've all had those days. I really like verse six. It's famous for a reason. Train up a child in the way he should go. Even when he is old, he will not depart from it. And that verse has kind of a light side and a dark side to it. The things that we receive when we're young tend to stick with us. And I think it's kind of interesting because obviously this is incredibly applicable to parents training children. And Scott makes a good point from this. It doesn't say control a child and mm-hmm. make them do what they're supposed to do. There's a big difference between controlling a child or controlling the situation and actually training the child and teaching them to choose the right thing. But of course, good training will last and bad training will last. But I think another way of looking at this verse, even for those who are not parents, is we're the child and we self-control. The things that we're doing to ourselves, we do train ourselves in some ways. And if you're training yourself in the ways of the Lord, it's going to help you down the road to keep doing the right thing. And if we're not training ourselves in the ways of the Lord, we're training ourselves in something else. And it's going to be harder and harder to depart from it when we're older. It's kind of like, you know, the people who think, oh, I'm going to have a thief on the cross, deathbed confession, you know, like, I'll just live my life for me. And then right before the end, I'll repent. And then like, that's like, if you spend your life training in wickedness, it's going to be all the harder when you're old to depart from. I'm not saying it's impossible, but like, don't plan on that. Like that's foolishness. So I think this is interesting. There's a couple of ways to think about that verse. But it also is sobering to me to think about both David and Solomon and the way they related as parents. Neither of them were very model fathers in the way they dealt with their children. And I mean, Solomon's son Rehoboam, notably, had probably all of this wisdom available to him. And he failed spectacularly and didn't listen to it. So, other thoughts or questions on that one? Verse 6. No, dude, it's better to stand up. Tim, you have.
You
breathe. So
I did.
I'll call on anything that breathes. So. All right. Anything else on verses 1-8?
Yeah. Verse 7 seems to be a combination of one of those truisms, this is the way it is, not saying it's right, but it's the way it is. Yeah. But also it's a combination of that and a warning. So
yeah.
The first part, the rich rules over the poor, that's just kind of how it tends to go. But the second part is really a warning. The borrower is the slave to the lender. So, you know, don't be a borrower. There's going to be certain situations that are not. There's wise and unwise borrowing, I'll put it that way. I think you can put yourself into a lot of trouble with that kind of situation, and especially if the reason you are borrowing is because you are not having self-control, or because you have not, you know, worked hard enough for, you know, like you're borrowing money because you don't have enough because you have been the slothful person, you know. So there's some principles behind why, but like you can really get yourself into a lot of trouble in that kind of situation.
Yeah, it's funny the way these things are timed. So we actually purchased a van last Thursday, and it's exciting. But I also really made some mistakes in the finishing process of it. The van itself was good, but the process with the extra add-ons and things, I was not prepared for some of those conversations. And I'm needing to go back and correct some for the borrower is the slave of the lender.
Yeah.
I was thinking about that on the way here. I was like, man, that proverb is hitting me between the eyes right now. And it's not anything catastrophic or anything. And it's, I think, all things that are correctable, because there's like cancellation terms. I went back and read the fine print. I was like, whew, I'm glad that there are some ways to make this better. But I'm learning right now.
So you're not getting hydraulic lifts on your van suspension?
Well, there was that. But I mean, besides that, and the LED lights underneath.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the speakers are actually on the outside of the car. Yeah.
Even more
that's
obnoxious. Right.
Yes.
Dead
of
night.
I want my Toyota Sienna riding right on the ground. Right with the tiny little wheels.
Bum, 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 bum.
Yes, thank you, Tim. Okay, wow. We're in fine form tonight. Matt,
did you go over three already?
Thank you. You brought us back.
Thank you,
Matt. Yeah, thank you, Matt.
No, go ahead. Take us away.
Yeah.
Actually, we did a little bit, but go ahead.
Well,
mine says
a prudent person foresees danger and takes precautions. The simpleton goes blindly on and suffers the consequences. Is he referring to prudent and simpleton in the context of rich and poor, like the ones surrounding it? Or
probably not, but sometimes that can be true. I think that generally the prudent could be a wise or a rich man or a poor man. It just kind of depends on the context. But he does talk a lot about riches and rich and poor. Verse 2 talks about it. Verse 4 talks about it. Verse 7 talks about it. Yeah, well, I hadn't noticed there's a lot of rich people.
I think kind of going off of that, it is helpful to remember that like rich does not equal wise.
Yes.
And poor doesn't equal stupid. Like life circumstances happen and it's not this correlation of, oh, you must have done something wrong to be this poor person. You can't have the wisdom that's given here.
Which is why it's important to read Job as well as read Proverbs.
Yeah.
Isn't it interesting studying those two books at the same time? Yes. We're studying Proverbs on Tuesday nights and Job on Wednesday nights. And so, man, it is like you see where the friends got like their concepts from, but you also see that they're proverbs, they're principles, not promises.
Yeah.
Because if you treat them as promises, and you look at verse 4, the reward for humility and fear of the Lord is riches and honor and life. And what's interesting about Job is like you see both ends of it, because like at the beginning, he does fear the Lord. He's blameless, upright, fearing the Lord and turning away from evil. He's described three times that way. And then it's all taken away from him. But he doesn't let go of his fear of the Lord. And the Lord gives him blessings at the end of the book. And so it's interesting that like Job has both. It's God's grace giving it both times. But it's just interesting thinking about this book with Job. Joe as well. Anything else through verse 8? All right, let's read 9 through 16. And Amy, would you read that for us?
Whoever has a bountiful eye will be blessed, for he shares his bread with the poor. Drive out a scoffer, and strife will go out, and quarreling and abuse will cease. He who loves purity of heart and whose speech is gracious will have the king as his friend. The eyes of the Lord keep watch over knowledge, but he overthrows the words of the traitor. The sluggard says, there is a lion outside. I shall be killed in the streets. The mouth of forbidden women is a deep pit. He with whom the Lord is angry will fall into it. Folly is bound up in the heart of a child, but the rod of discipline drives it far from him. Whoever oppresses the poor to increase his own wealth or gives to the rich will only come to poverty.
Okay. Thoughts or comments, questions on this last little bit here? Tim?
16 is a warning to the lender. you know, as much as it is a warning to, you know, don't get yourself into a borrower situation. Don't, from verse 7. Whoever oppresses the poor to increase his own wealth or gives to the rich will only come to poverty. It's unfortunate that the power tends to follow money and both will corrupt.
Yep.
We need to be above that, especially if, you know, whether God blesses us with riches or not, we need to make sure we're not corrupted by the riches or the desire for them.
Yes, amen. I also think it's interesting the giving to the rich is mentioned there, because it doesn't talk a lot about that. And I think the idea is like giving to the rich in hopes of getting something in return. Oftentimes that there's, we're seeking favors from people that, you know, we think will do that. And Jesus talked about that. When you give a feast, invite the poor, invite the people who can't pay you back. Don't invite the rich in hopes of, you know, getting some benefit from them. Other things that stand out to you guys here in this section.
Well, the sluggard got off the couch. I just want to say that. Yeah, he's running in fear.
Yeah. Or he's just staying inside.
Oh, do you think he's paralyzed with fear?
In verse 13.
Yeah.
I've always read that as an excuse. Like, hey, why don't you go to work? Oh, there's a lion in the street.
Oh, is that what that is? Okay.
Yeah. I could have been killed, you know.
Sounds like a kid making up an excuse for why he didn't do his chores and clean up his room. It's like, why didn't you straighten up your closet? There's a monster in there.
Yeah. I've always read that as an excuse of like, oh no, they can't go. It's just sometimes we can be lazy out of fear. And so that's what's going on here. I mean, because if there is a lion outside, I don't really want to go out either. I think the idea is there's not actually a lion outside, but he says there's a lion outside. Big difference.
You can say he's a lion.
He's lying about the lion. Got a slug, a sloth, and a lion.
Oh my.
So verse 15, I kind of had a realization about that, the concept, like, so it says folly is bound up in the heart of a child, but the rod of discipline drives it far from him. And when you first read it, you're like, man, like the rod of discipline, that sounds so aggressive. But thinking about in the context of Psalms and Proverbs, and even when we were reading earlier about the rod of fury, where we're talking about, like, where I was talking about the rod and staff of God and of a shepherd, and it's not like a rod, like you're beating someone necessarily. It's a rod of guidance and directing them and using it to herd them towards the direction they're supposed to go in. So it's not like you're like beating someone over the head with what they're supposed to do, but it's discipline in the sense of guidance and teaching them to choose the safe path.
Yes. Yeah, I really think there's a difference between the rod of fury in verse 8 and the rod of discipline in verse 15. Mm-hmm. And that's an important point. Is the Proverbs do, I do think this is talking about corrective, you know, corporal punishment, but it is never to be done in fury, never to be done in anger, but in love and in calmness. And regardless of what method of discipline you use, there's a brother, Marty Broadwell, just really good series on like parenting and stuff, and he does a lot with the first half of the verse where he says folly is bound up in the heart of a child. Like, the goal of discipline is to remove folly from the heart of the child. So there's so many things to think about. That you're not just trying to control the situation or make them stop something, you're trying to remove folly from their heart, which is so different than just controlling the situation or just like, hey, stop doing that, it's annoying me. It's like, well, is it actually folly or is it just annoying you? And that was his big thing, was like identifying what is actually folly. If a child knocks over their cup at the dinner table and it spills all over the table, you might be frustrated with that, but is it folly or not? It depends. It depends, because if the child was doing something you told them not to do and they were disobeying, it might be folly. Or if you were saying, hey, be careful, and then as a result of not being careful, they, you know, continued horsing around and then knocked over. Well, where's the folly? The folly wasn't actually in knocking the cup over. It was in the not being careful. That was the instruction.
Tom Fowler.
Yeah, Tom Fowler. There you go. There you go. Tom Foolery, Fowlery.
We spend too much time with dads. It's just rubs off.
It's good. It's good. And this is a proverb for dads. So this is appropriate that we have some dad jokes going on. This is good. This is helpful. But that has been really helpful for me now as a parent, like, because there's a ton of times where I'm tempted to discipline just because I'm frustrated or I'm tired or I'm like, please stop that. When actually they're not doing anything wrong. There's not folly there. But sometimes you can move something into the folly category by making a rule about it and saying, okay, this is now a rule. And so like, now, and so it's because sometimes a child might do something that they're not supposed to do, but they don't know not to do it. That's not necessarily folly yet, but it leads to folly. But once you teach them and say, okay, now this is a no-no.
Right.
Now, if they do it, that's being a fool. They're rebelling against things. And to also ask themselves, is it just they forgot, or is it that they remembered, knew not to do it, and did it anyway? Because all those things require different levels of response from the parent. A rebellious, bold-faced thing is different than a I forgot, which is different from a you never told me. I didn't know.
One of the hardest parts about parenting sometimes is trying to discern why something was done.
Yeah.
Not just what was done.
Yes, amen. But what's wonderful about all this is, as you know, you come back to the discipline of the Lord, his rod and his staff comfort us. Like, God is always perfect at disciplining us. He knows exactly why we're doing what we're doing and can help guide us and correct us and lead us. And that's helpful.
I don't know exactly how to frame this thought, but one thing that stuck out to me, I watched Joe Works's series of lessons on parenting. And the one thing he said he hated to hear parents say was, I'm not my kid's friend, which is like, the way he explained it was, you're supposed to be your kid's friend. Because if you're thinking that your kid is friends with somebody who is a sluggard or is influencing them to do bad things or, you know, isn't saved or is trying to lead them down a dark path, that's not a friend. You know, you want to be what a good friend is, because if we're to be the friend of the Lord's, then that type of relationship should be reflected in our own friendships. And so we should want to be that close with our kid, where if they do something stupid, you need to pull them out of that fire, or you need to protect them against that and show them that there are consequences for actions that they take that aren't good. And so having that balance of treating them like a friend, where, you know, like the instance of you don't want to punish them because they're being, you know, irritating or loud or obnoxious, but leveling with them, just being like, hey, you know, I just be mindful of the people around you, you know, be mindful of what you're doing and how that could affect others. You know, it's not necessarily a wrong thing, but you're being inconsiderate or you're being XYZ. And then maybe at some point, like you said, you could move it into the folly category by setting a rule of no screaming after 9 p.m. or whatever, you right. know.
And then the consistency of following through on the rules that exactly. you do make, that's the other hard part. It's like, if you make a rule, you have to be ready to remember it and enforce it. So many good proverbs on parenting in here, but this is one of my favorites because of that concept of like, what is actually folly?
Yeah.
Not just what annoys me or what I don't like, but like, what according to the Lord is folly?
Mm-hmm.
And how can there be appropriate discipline to remove it from the heart? That's the goal of training up a child in the way he should go. And that's a lot harder than just, you know, going off on a kid because they're annoying you. But there's a world of difference between training and just
doing those things. That's the role of an uncle, not a parent.
All right. Other thoughts or comments here? We're almost out of time.
Verse 10, drive out a scoffer and strife will go out and quarreling and abuse will cease. I think that's kind of that's good wisdom for like in a situation you need to, like if somebody's just like, it can't be corrected, you got to get them out because they're just causing all these problems. But I'm also thinking about it from the scoffer's point of view. If everywhere you go, there's strife and quarreling and abuse.
What's the common denominator?
What's the common denominator? There's somebody I know who, like, every time, every place they work, they would tell me about this problem, this problem, this problem, this problem, this drama, and all these things. And I just started to think, could it be? Could it,
the story,
could it be that you maybe noticed that nobody else has this consistent of a problem? Now, this person no longer reports such, and maybe there's been some change, or maybe I didn't know, but still, it did occur to me that, like, maybe, just maybe, that was the common denominator.
I remember my dad, one of the stories you tell is the guy who gets some, like, some of the stinky cheese on his mustache. I forget, like, what type of cheese, but you fill in your, you know,
Limburger
cheese. There you go. Some Limburger cheese on his mustache. He's like, this room stinks. So he goes in the other room. This room stinks. So he goes outside. The whole world stinks. And, you know, same principle of, maybe it's not that the whole world stinks, but it might be you. But it's helpful thinking about this. And I thought about that too in verse 10, that also from the other end of, like, there's times where getting to where you realize this person is removed from the situation, everything calms down. And we want to be patient with people. We don't want to be quick to, I think in our cancel culture world or toxic people, you know, we have to be really careful with this. I saw a thing one time that said, like, if God got all the toxic people out of his life, none of us would be here, kind of a thing. But there is some truth to some of that. That talks about, like, if you realize that the person you're dealing with is a fool, or in this case, a scoffer, who's the, you know, a fool in context here. There's times where there needs to be a separation. And you got to be willing to move on from certain relationships in your life so that the other quarreling will calm down and things can be resolved.
And if you compare that to the church discipline that's described in the New Testament, it starts with trying to work with the person, trying to help change them, guide them, direct them. And if they refuse to an ever-growing, you know, presence of people who help it, trying to help them change, then they need to be removed from the situation.
Yeah.
But first you try to remove the sin from them or help them to remove the sin from themselves.
Yeah, that is right. I remember the specific verse on a factious man remove after first and second warning. But I can't remember. I'm finding the other one in 2 Thessalonians. But anyway, the church discipline principle is absolutely applicable. It's wisdom. Anything else y'all have on Proverbs 22, 9 through 16?
Verse 11 just reminds me of a lot of Bible stories of, like, Daniel and Joseph, where they had such purity of heart and just constantly sought the Lord and tried to do the very best within circumstances, and who thought through who they were going to, what they were saying, and did have the king as their friend due to their wisdom.
Nehemiah 2. Sorry. I studied that recently. But it's also, I thought that verse is cool in realizing that the Lord will be our friend as well, the king. All right, well, thank you guys very much for good comments, good discussion tonight. So next week, we're going to start this 30 Sayings of the Wise section, and we'll take a couple of weeks at least to go through that. And this is going to be a little bit more like the introduction to Proverbs, in that, like we talked about, it's rare to find a four-line proverb. Well, these 30 sayings, several of them are going to be four lines, six lines, or sometimes these are much longer than the two-line proverbs that we've been getting. So these won't fit on fortune cookies as easily as the two-line proverbs we've been looking at.
Just use smaller font.
Yeah. Always fix it with the font. All right. Let's wrap up with a prayer tonight. Tim, would you take us in prayer? Sure.
God, our Father in heaven, we thank you so much for these words of wisdom for how much we can learn from studying even just a few verses of your word. We thank you for this time together with others who are also seeking your wisdom and wanting to please you. Please help us to be humble. Please help us to accept a correction from your word. And if we are being stubborn or hard-hearted, please correct us gently, but help us to see the error of our ways and help us to learn to serve you better. Help us to encourage each other. Help us to have wisdom in how to deal with various situations and to be discerning in the way that we talk to each other, the way that we speak to others about you. Please help us to represent you well as Christians and help us to glorify you in all that we do. We thank you so much for the hope that we have in Jesus. Please help us to live lives that demonstrate the value of that hope and the value of the salvation that we have in Jesus. And we pray these things in his name. Amen. Amen. So I have a question.